Welcome to episode 176 of Industry Misinterpretations with James Robertson and Michael Lucas-Smith. This week, we spoke to Brian Rice about the Slate language, which you can find out more about at slatelanguage.org. And we spoke about where it came from, where it's going to, where you can get it, and what you can do with it. If you have feedback on this or any other episode of Industry Misinterpretations, please send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. You can also head on over to iTunes and leave a comment for us. We would really appreciate it if you did that. You can head on over to Podcast Alley, cast a vote for the podcast. And of course, you can interact with us in the Industry Misinterpretations group at Facebook and the Small Talkers group at Ning. James Robertson, Syncom Small Talk Product Evangelist. I'm here with Michael Lucas-Smith, one of our engineers working primarily on Web Velocity.
G'day.
And also Brian Rice, who's here to talk to us about Slate.
Howdy.
So, Brian, let's kick off. Slate's been around for a little while. I remember talking to you about it maybe back in the 2003-2005 timeframe. I don't remember exactly when, but it was a number of years ago. Why don't you tell us where Slate came from and what it is?
So, yeah, you're right. That was 2003 and 2005 when I was visiting small talk conferences and trying to get some feedback and, you know, sharing what we were going after. Slate is a project that's kind of existed in my head and maybe sometimes in code off and on since I think it was the existence of Self. I first got to try Self in college in 1995. And it was the first small talk I ever laid hands on, and I'd read about it before, and it appealed to me, and especially some of the ideas that were there, but it seemed kind of half done, and I felt like, you know, there was more that could be done. So I put together something in college, and it was, you know, a little undergrad project, not terribly, you know, fascinating, but it was fun. It was like it fit on a floppy, and it had a little Morphic interface, and and I had an interpreter, but, you know, life intervened, and I went off and did some other stuff. And then after a while, I came back, and language design seemed like a good kind of way to hone my skills in ways that the traditional jobs that I had, which were usually web development and so forth, weren't quite delivering. I mean, they, you know, you could learn plenty of things in web development, but in the early aughts, a lot of it was still, you know, slap together, or, you know, welcome to this, you know, commercial framework or something like that. So, yeah, in 2003 to 2005 was the first big effort to put something together, and we bootstrapped the system. And then after that, we kind of lost focus, but things are coming back together again, and that's why I want to talk about it again, and why I think it's now going to become, you know, a lot more usable and relevant.
Yeah, I noticed there's a website that's become a little more active recently, slate.org, and you've got some posts up there and a little bit of documentation. I followed a few of the links, and some of them are live, some of them are dead. Well, dead's not the right word for them, just unfilled maybe is the right word, but I did run across the About page, and yeah, I can see where you were influenced, obviously, by Self. I guess the question I'd ask, and probably Michael will have a lot more on this than I will, JavaScript is also a prototype-based language, so I guess is there any JavaScript-type influence in this, or is this primarily coming from what you've picked up from Self?
Well, not from the language design aspect, but from the JavaScript communities that have been maturing over the last two or three years, especially since jQuery and prototype became sort of not just interesting, but they became default assumptions. That you would have some interesting library at the core of your JavaScript runtime. Now you've got the V8 runtime, and you've got Node.js and Common.js that are set up and kind of assume that you're going to be doing some more interesting modular programming and maybe server-side programming. And now so they've been... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Now, well, you just threw in some names there that we haven't mentioned on this podcast before. Node.js in particular... Maybe that's worthwhile just touching on briefly, because it's really interesting. So
yeah.
you, you know the V8 engine that's in the Chrome browser?
Right.
Well, some people have made a standalone version of that, added a whole bunch of primitives to do things like files and sockets and all that kind of stuff. And you can run it sort of standalone on your server. And then there's the V8 CGI, which is the fast CGI plugin for Apache, which, you know, combines those two things. And then there's this extra project called Node.js, which is a sort of, I guess you would say, a Comet-based framework for server-side, client-side JavaScript communication.
Mm-hmm. That's accurate.
Yeah, it's a fairly hefty piece of technology set right there, and it makes a lot of sense. However, I have to say that actually getting it all up and running is, I like the bleeding edge, but I don't like it when the bleeding edge bleeds on me, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, the people doing this work this is what happens when in any language adoption curve. When Python started getting used for web development, Guido, I believe, if I'm going to sort of quote or take the sentiment correctly, was kind of appalled that something like Zope or Web Frameworks on it existed. He said, "This is not what I made it for. You know, it's designed for very easy to read scripting that, you know, just starts from the ground and stays kind of pretty close to the ground." And then, you know, of course, you know, plenty of large frameworks have been done in PHP, which was at even more humble beginnings. So I see JavaScript doing that, and it's got some issues as far as, like, you know, what can be done with it standards wise, due to a certain company that might be near Seattle where I came from. And it's, you know, and it was designed pretty quickly for Netscape, and but it's got some interesting properties. It's got real closures. It's got, you know, as far as whatever you can do realistically with it, it's got real objects and real message passing. So it doesn't have real concurrency, and Node.js gets closer to that, and that's the one thing. But anyway.
So back to what you were saying.
Oh, which bit? I lost track myself. Sorry.
Let's jump back to the relationship between these ideas that were and are floating around with things like JavaScript and were floating around with Self, and how you're applying them in your idea with Slate.
Oh, yeah. So that's a good pattern right there. And StrongTalk fits into that, too. All of these all form an arc, and it has nothing, as far as I'm concerned, very little to do with prototypes, even though that's kind of the norm there. But it has more to do with having a runtime that flattens your call graph, that decides based on profiling that, you know, something that you've written that has a really high level of abstraction that goes through multiple layers to get to the functionality that it wants and wants to compose it in a kind of a fine-grained way can flatten it out and decide, yeah, okay, so I've got a million method calls inside of here, but because this is so important, it's just going to be a single method with the code in line. And JavaScript programmers have gotten the benefit from that, and they're still learning what to do with it. Self provided everybody with the first researchy taste of it. And the idea of Slate, like when we first decided, you know, this crazy idea I had, you know, whatever, going bouncing around in my head for years, was worth actually making a real runtime for. The idea was that Self and StrongTalk had gotten some money, and, you know, some work was done behind them, some very smart guys who happen to now be working on V8 or some other VMs. But it just sort of, you know, got lost maybe in the proprietary sense for StrongTalk, or you know, Sun bought it and just sort of let it sit around for a while they got the engineers working on something else. And we wanted something that was free and was a little more self-defined, so to speak. And that's where we went with, like, the MIT license, and we decided, well, we're not really going to be something that's, you know, a Squeak dependent thing, even though we all know and love Squeak. And I even designed all the libraries to be designed for inlining, and that's actually our big stumbling block that we're finally getting over, is that we designed it for a runtime that had inlining, and we never put together the right engineering to make that happen. And we're really close now. because of some redesigns and some ways of going about it that means we don't have to be clever to do it. So, and I could talk about that at length, of course, but I don't know where you guys want to go with this. So.
Well, Michael will probably have questions in that regard in a second. I wanted to ask something going a little further back. When you started this, you mentioned that you had initially back, I guess, in college or right after worked a little bit on this and had something working in an interpreter sense in Squeak. Are you still hosting in Squeak? I mean, because that's sort of how the Newspeak guys were going, or are you doing your own thing completely now?
We never hosted in Squeak, actually. Even when I wrote something that booted on a floppy that was kind of written in kind of hand-coded C and assembly and some other stuff, and obviously the source files for the hosted language were, you know, some little weird Lisp dialect, I think. I don't even remember how it went now. What we did was we wrote an interpreter in Common Lisp, prototyped out the algorithms, and defined everything as like Common Lisp structs and records and stuff like that, and arrays. And then we bootstrapped pretty much straight off of that. And those were rough times. Common Lisp is a dynamic language itself, and while you can optimize pretty well and do type inference, it took a while to get off of there, and of course we had very little tools, so I wrote things like an Emacs mode. And we thought about writing an IDE in Squeak and kind of cross-hosting that way, not actually runtime hosting, but just kind of, you know, putting development tools in Squeak and allowing us to browse around, but it never quite came together. There's always some, like, I remember writing a couple of experiments and then thinking, you know what, I don't want to have to try to meld, it's like a relational object kind of what do you call it? The impedance mismatch.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it felt like that. I mean, Slate's no relational algebra, but having multi-methods and prototypes at the same time means you've got two different dimensions that you're adjusting in order to get the tools to fit. And it just kind of never made sense. So
is tools something you're ever going to be able to do in a reasonable fashion? I mean, well, this is one of the distinguishing factors between Smalltalk and, say, just about everything else, right?
Sure. Common Lisp and Dylan have had, at various times, decent browsers. And Common Lisp and Dylan both have multi-methods. And they usually phrase things in terms of generic functions. So that's always it's another one of those dimensional shifts. You're looking at things as a bunch of functions with the same name specialized to different types, rather than looking at a class and then deciding, well, what features does this participate in? So in Slate, actually, we do look at it as, like, we're going to have, and we do have a model for a browser, and we have some GTK code that allows you to inspect and see what methods are on it, but the UI isn't where we want it. You look at what we call roles, the idea that, you know, in Smalltalk or any other single dispatch language, you'll have a method dictionary. Well, Slate has a method dictionary. It's just partitioned by, like, the position that a class participates in for a method. I use the word class, but of course I mean an object or something. But, you know, it's the same idea. You find some functionality and you look at the behavior it supports, but you can see that things like, well, if I'm the first argument in this phrase, you know, this is how I participate. And if I'm, you know, over here, I'm actually, you know, secondary to the behavior, but I still participate. And my type still matters to how this works.
And now a short break for David Buck's Design Minute.
This is David Buck with today's Cimbron Design Minute. Blocks are one of the key language features of Smalltalk. They allow you to encapsulate an operation into an object to be performed whenever you wish. Usually, blocks are evaluated further down in the call tree. In other words, you pass a block as a parameter through a number of methods, and eventually one of the methods evaluates the block and returns. It's possible, however, to store a block into a variable and use it even after the method that created it has returned. This is where you can run into trouble. Blocks are hard to figure out just by looking at them. If they're in a data structure, an inspector can show you that the object is a block, but can't easily show you what will happen when you execute the block. The only way to determine what it does is to evaluate the block and run through it with a debugger. Blocks can also cause problems when you're trying to persist them. It's hard to map a block into the database and back without having problems. In the end, you should consider the costs of using blocks before committing to use them as data in your application. This has been a Cimbron Design Minute. Cimbron offers training and consulting in object-oriented development and the Smalltalk programming language. For more information, visit www.cimbron.com or email info@cimbron.com.
And now, back to the regular podcast.
So you do believe you'll be able to have tools then? I found that fascinating. I mean, Slate seems to be a kind of large grab bag of programming techniques, much like Factor in that respect. So you can sort of redefine the entire thing while you're running. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that in tools? I mean, you sort of, well, you can't, right?
There is a basic object model. And I think one of the ideas that I sort of latched onto, and it's still just a, you know, a set of files that I've been playing with, is the techniques from using the OmniBrowser framework from Squeak. And there's something new now, which I'm not remembering right. I want to say meta browsing, but that sort of sounds sort of silly. However, that may exactly be the name. Basically, to meta model, you know, whatever type of navigation or spatial sort of partition you want of the stuff that you care about, and then, you know, then the basically that there's some sort of thing that can take meta models and turn them into lightweight tools that do most of what you want. And of course, you can decorate them to get more, but, you know.
So the introspection into a runtime system has to rely on the runtime system itself.
It does. It does.
Yeah.
I've noticed in Slate, I mean, I can write scheme style or I can write common list style, and you're absolutely right, and that's a conscious choice we made, is we wanted to be able to support kind of a as best we could, given some of the choices we made, a continuum of approaches, of ways of expressing oneself. And that's, it kind of gets to why I like language design, or what my contribution I feel is the idea of like a prose, of means of expression, being able to take an idea and being able to render it in a language that helps you realize, you know, helps you realize what the breakdowns are, you know, where the surprising moments are, and also what directions it can go, and so forth. So, I've spent a lot of time doing things like consulting, where I get to look into a client's code base, and I learn some lessons. And for me, sometimes the only way to take those away is to take something very abstract out of it and decide to write a little library in Slate. And so Slate is often littered with, like, not really half done projects, but stuff that's like, you know, it's interesting that I've got this type of tree data structure or this weird, you know, interesting application of the streaming library. Most young languages don't really have that. And it's because I seek to kind of figure out, you know, what can Slate do like this? Or how can I take this idea and leverage every single feature that makes sense from a language that, you know, is designed to kind of adapt itself, and see what it makes the idea look like? Is like by upgrading enough features in a language so that you get a lot of possibilities, does that put you over a horizon to where you can see something else that most people can't see?
Yeah, one discussion we had recently I found really interesting was how to handle events. And generally, events are done as a named lookup, and then you run a whole bunch of callbacks. But you posited to me that why not just send a message that happens to have been implemented either dynamically or statically at, you know, at compile time or runtime, that has a criteria for its execution that requires the event to have fired. I thought that was really interesting.
Well, that isn't even my idea. I think it's something that kind of grew out of the Squeak and the Smalltalk. I guess it's now portable. Yes, it is now portable. Sometimes I don't keep track of things, but the announcements framework. How I mean, just the idea of passing around objects and thinking about them as the same sorts of things as exceptions, except that they get thrown or get communicated in a different dimension rather than up a runtime stack. There's a broadcast, you know, subscribe or pub sub or whatever you want to call it, idea, and that these things have, you know, they can have behaviors and they can have structured, predefined responses. And Slate already kind of has something set up for that, including like the way its exception system works. We have object-oriented, what we call restarts. So we have a way so you can encapsulate a way to handle an exception or a condition in a way that, you know, responds to messages, can have state, also, you know, participates further in the process, and it makes things a little more expressive.
I'm curious, is Slate stackless? You know, there's a stackless Python that you can use, and basically it's continuation passing style. Is Slate like that?
It used to be. Actually, wait, let me think about this. We changed the runtime over the process of the last 2 years. I can say now that no, we don't. We have an array of frames, and of course, everything's introspectable, so there is a way to kind of grab out a delimited continuation or something like that. And
is this because of debuggability? You know, because as soon as you have continuations, then you don't really have the whole stack anymore. So is this about introspection and debuggability?
I suppose so. Yeah, I'm not sure I know what a good answer to that is. I can tell you what we have. We have a register based stack. You can go down, you know, all of its pure Slate code. The C stack sometimes gets involved, and for that reason, we've modified the VM so that it, you know, the garbage collector doesn't step on things. You can take out, for example, we've got a class that represents something on the stack as a register set, and then you can pull it out and say, I want to save this, or I want to treat this as an object in the debugger. And yeah, we've got a full source level debugger that allows you to go up and down the stack and, you know, really look at things without having to dig through, you know, offset tables and weird stuff like that.
So does that mean that garbage collection also has to use the same introspection code?
No, it has to be aware of of what on the stack. Well, let me think about this. The stack is a pure Slate array, so that's pretty simple. It's the VM's C stack. That's the one thing that gets a little tricky. It's just whenever if a GC gets, you know, called and something's on the C stack, well, you know, you have to know which one of those are Slate pointers. And that's just a simple matter of we went from C to C++, so we can actually say, yes, we know that these, you know, function results that get put here, you know, actually need to be followed. And so you can't just sort of strip something off, you know, and tenure it or, you know, whatever. So the GC really doesn't. The GC and the VM, they know about like the interpreter structure, and they know about some other things that are in the image, but they're all pure Slate. So they're not. There's nothing like little magical about them, other than the VM knows that these particular objects need to be linked, and you know, I need to know which one of these things is the blah blah blah, you know, that sort of thing.
As the programmer using Slate, how free are you to define your own memory structures and memory spaces and that sort of stuff?
Relatively free, although we don't exercise that very much. What we do, we have a couple of facilities. One is that I specialized something we call the external resource framework. And all external resources, usually it represents like a file or a socket handle. It has an object that says or an attribute that is a locator, which basically specifies if I close this and reopen it, you know, here's the declarative way of getting at that. So it's a file path or some spec to tell you how to open a socket that does the same thing as before. And we made an external resource subtype for malloc areas. And so you can use that as a byte area, and you can also allocate objects in there. And the VM will not currently track those things, and you know, right now, that's for what, for the purposes that we do sometimes use that for, it's a feature rather than a defect. We don't want, you know, something super complex going on inside there. So normally we stick to the main heap, which has, you know, two generations and, you know, mark sweep com back collection and that sort of thing. And the VM is small enough and modular enough that we could act on a specialized, similar, like, external resource type that would work almost exactly like the malloc and might say, actually, you know, every time you invoked some particular routine that allocated an object in there, it would actually somehow register that with the garbage collector or something like that. So any references it had, you know, it would count, you know, that sort of thing.
Just how, I mean, talking about Slate and reading up on Slate, just, and it's called the clean Slate Smalltalk. Just how Smalltalk is this? Doesn't seem to be very Smalltalk at all, really.
Well, we hew to some basic things, which are keyword, phrase, message syntax, you know, square bracket blocks, which behave more or less the same as in Smalltalk, and message passing. And that's generally it. And, you know, there's a tension there. You know, if you go clean slate, if you decide that really, you know, at some point, you know, you're going to be self-defining a philosophy and going and, you know, changing things around in ways that make something internally consistent or maybe consistent with some vision that you have, you know, what is the value of going back and making that named the same thing as in Smalltalk or behave the same way? And we've got like a couple of libraries that do things like, you know, take things like, I think we call something extensible sequence, and it's basically ordered collection. And in ordered collection, if you think about it in the abstract type, we may said, well, yes, there's a sequence of things, and some of them are fixed size, and some of them are extensible. So the very first one's going to be extensible collection. And then the one that has just a basic array underneath it and has some buffer on ends of it, we're going to call that extensible array. And then we have a bunch of other ones that are, you know, a little more, like one's oriented more towards queue usage, and it just has a little economic kind of shift around so that, you know, if you want to use it as a stack or a queue, you know, it does the right thing rather than allocates too many arrays or something like that. Sometimes we decide, you know what, we're done doing, you know, a particular small talk selector, and there's no one around to sort of tell us, hey, wait a minute, we all care about that. So we kind of go where we like. And I think that might be a good thing. I don't know if it's a good thing for small talk, but I don't know that we're really detracting from any community that I'm aware of. We have some squeakers who keep track of things, and a lot of them look on Slate as like a yet another, you know, interesting pool of ideas to draw from if they decide they want to go in some particular direction.
So there's the learning research group. Is that what they're called?
I don't think that they're called that anymore. Viewpoints research.
Viewpoint. Yeah. What? They're trying to. They're the ones using Cola and Pepsi, right?
Yeah, the Future of New Computing Project.
Yeah, that's the one.
They're similar, and they've got they're similar in the sense of like, well, they just sort of decide exactly how they want to do things, and I have not heard anything really from them in 2 years.
Well, Armeta was the last thing, right?
I believe so, yes. And that has had some good success and been porting to JavaScript and done some other interesting things. But I remember that the most recent email was a query from someone on the list to say, hey, is anybody alive there? And I think Kim Rose responded, but not with anything terribly informative. So so I keep track. I don't know. But yes, they go through Scheme and Smalltalk syntax, and they bounce back and forth. Like, one's used for a certain layer and another one's used for another layer. And of course they can bootstrap whatever language they want on top of it. So they go in all sorts of different directions. And we too have, we've made some decisions, usually lexically, that makes Slate a lot different. For example, I mean, binary selectors, we accept anything that you kind of glom together that happens to have the traditional Smalltalk binary selector characters on either end. So if it's got angle brackets on the side of it, it's a binary selector. But not that I'm really terribly excited about that, but it does make for some interesting possibilities. And basically, yeah. until Slate really gets some serious users and, you know, some sort of behavior occurs to me or somebody else is unruly, like, hey, it's all nice that he can do some weird stuff with that web framework of his, but that's interfering with the general behavior of the system because of these things. Well, then we're going to sit down and figure out.
Now a short interlude for this week's Squeak News with Randall Schwartz.
This is Randall Schwartz here with your latest Squeak News. You can find all this news and more at news.squeak.org. Goran Crompy has begun the process for this year's elections for the Squeak Oversight Board. The Squeak Oversight Board, also known as the SOB, consists of 7 members from our community, all of whom are elected by popular vote. The members are responsible for building a legal presence, currently by working with the Software Freedom Law Center as part of their conservancy, providing the network services that support the various mailing lists and repositories that are in turn make a community possible, helping coordinate the various interest groups and projects being pursued by Squeakers, and making decisions where there is no clear community's consensus. The current board members are Giselle Assumpcio Jr., Ken Causey, Bert Freudenberg, Craig Latta, Andreas Robb, Randall Schwartz, who's that? Igor Stasinsko. The schedule and process of the election is as follows. Nominations. Candidates should nominate themselves by the 3rd of March and start their campaign on the SqueakDev mailing list. Or, if you nominate someone else, be sure that the person really wants to run. Goran will not put anyone on the candidate list until that person makes it known on SqueakDev that he or she does also want to run. Final candidate list. The list will be closed on the 3rd of March. The candidates should ideally present themselves on SqueakDev unless they have already done so, and the community can ask questions. Online election starts. The voting period starts on the 10th of March at 6 p.m., 1800 UTC, and is 1 week long. Ballots are sent out via email. Online election ends. The voting process will end on the 17th of March at 6 p.m., 1800 UTC. Results will be announced immediately when the election ends. Registering. If you were invited to vote last year, you are already on the voter list. No worries. If you are a new Squeaker and wish to vote, do one of the following. Get a known Squeaker to vouch for you. If a known Squeaker sends email to voters@squeak.org giving your name and email address, then Goran will add you. Or send an email to voters@squeak.org yourself and CC to SqueakDev if you like, with information and arguments showing that you are indeed serious about voting and that you are indeed a Squeaker. When the voting period starts, all voters will receive an email with instructions and a link to the voting website. Everything about the election, including the schedule above and more, can be tracked at the Squeak Wiki at wiki.squeak.org/squeak/6150. For Squeak Weekly News, this is Randall Schwartz. You can also check out my Smalltalk-related blog at methodsandmessages.vox.com.
And now, back to the regular podcast.
I've been pondering an idea of late, sort of blending Ometa with general programming. You know, what if you could, as well as define the prerequisites for calling a method, you could also define the parsing rules for the function you're about to create, and naturally you would inherit your code from parsers. So you're basically including micro parsing rules for the lexical scope of what you're compiling at that particular time. So you can basically invent a new syntax whenever it's appropriate and keep it isolated to the code that's going to use it.
Interesting. There's a cost-benefit analysis there, of course. You know, someone has to figure out, you know, and well, I mean, if you go the route of language customization, you know, down to the finest detail, it's just like having macros. You know, a lot of people from the outside of the Lisp world look at macros and say, well, doesn't that, you know, dirty up things? And yes, there's a way to do something called macro let, which means you can write a macro just for the specific function call or the specific lexical scope of some other function calls you want to do. But it does involve a trade-off. You have to think about, is it time to do that? And once you've done that, did I make the right choice? Is this something I really want to maintain, or have I gone down, you know, a customization path that that's cute, but you know, might hurt me later. Like I come back and read it later and start thinking like, what was I thinking? What was this about? You know, I thought these words made sense at one point.
Yeah. I mean, when we load a library into our program, we're flooding our execution space with all these tokens. I guess, you know, we try to isolate that somewhat either by namespacing the names, which in C means including some sort of prefix, or in Smalltalk, it means you put it on a particular kind of class. But, you know, that's a solution that just kind of lets the problem grow even larger.
Yeah, maybe so.
And, you know, it's all a matter of I guess, scoping things better. So if you're able to scope stuff, so you say, I want to be able to use strings, but I want to use these funky strings and just for this little bit here because I need those funky strings, then you may as well go down to the level of, and whenever I put angle brackets, that means I'm referencing a URL and the stuff between the angle brackets is a URL object. So now I don't have to create URLs from strings that can be built at compile time, or you know, things like that.
Yeah, interesting.
And I think that kind of gives us the best of both worlds with Ometa and real programming. And I say that with tongue in cheek because I love what the Ometa guys are doing, but it generally seems like, well, you know, you can't build a classical sort of application using the Ometa techniques. You need more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you always come across some piece of syntax somewhere and you just go, why is this in my language, right? You know, Perl is sort of like the ultimate example of syntaxitis, where everything in the language is a piece of syntax. And, you know, some people really like to program that way. So you could almost enable them to program that way if they really wanted to. And you keep them, you can keep their library isolated. So, okay, these guys pull in all of this funky syntax and write this library that does genetic sequencing, but I can call that from my program and I just use OO techniques. And that would be really nice, I think.
Actually, I wanted to jump to something that came up a couple of minutes ago. You were mentioning about until somebody took this and used it for real, and that kind of gave the thought to my mind, what if somebody wanted to take a look at Slate right now and use it? Where do they go and what can they get?
Okay, so, well, there's the website, which I waited too late to correct. It's actually not slate.org. I wish I owned that. It belongs to somebody who has the Slate family, I believe. It's Slate language, and from there you can basically go to Google Code. And for a little while, we had a kind of a haphazard system because we were using GitHub repositories hosted elsewhere. But now that Google Code supports Mercurial, we've got a bi-directional, and this is honestly something that a newbie should not have to think about, but the point is, now you don't have to think about it, is that the source code is on Google Code, and you can do an extraction. We don't store the images there. We store them on the downloads. So there's an instruction page on the Google Code that says there's the images on the side panel, and then you grab code and you mix the two together. You either get a tarball or you get a source checkout. And then once there, you start with a README. It's a command line setup for the default. We don't have a desktop that loads up just by automatic inclusion. Partly because the one we do have uses GTK, and that means, well, you got to build something and release something, so it gets a little tricky. You can set up like an Emacs mode, or if you like Vim, or you know. I don't know, something else. I think I wrote a TextMate mode once, which still works.
Actually, just one question before I give this back to Michael. Along those lines, what platforms can you run on? You mentioned TextMate, so that implies Mac, and you mentioned a bunch of things that implies Linux. So Linux and Mac you mentioned there, basically. What platforms all can you run this on?
Okay, so the system will build under any GCC toolchain, and it'll build on any generally C compiler toolchain if you mess with it enough. Of course, we just generally stick with a GNU toolchain because that's a little easier to assume. And usually people who are off the beaten path can kind of fend for themselves. And of course, if they need to, they can send us patches. But we don't, you know, go around, you know, looking for weird Solaris boxes to build stuff on.
no, we do that at SynCom. Nobody else should do that.
Oh, you ought to. Yeah, yeah. But yeah, for a 2 or 3 man project, it gets a little out of hand. We do have old provisions for it. It's just they've been untested for a while. But anyway, we also have a Visual Studio project, which gets updated once every few months, and you know, I should probably go revisit that at some point. But it's kept in source, you know, source control, so you can open it up, and you'll probably find a few differences you can, you know, tweak out. But you can do a full Windows build, 64-bit or 32-bit. One thing right now, I believe that we don't support is a big Indian system, and there's a bug, and it's pretty straightforward. But we need someone who's really dedicated on a big Indian platform to kind of go look at it if they really care. And that's more or less it. Once we got 64 and 32-bit compatible, that seemed to iron out a lot of the usual niggly features that you get with a C backend when you decide that you're going to, you know, run on a C tool chain and try to, you know, handle a bunch of different platforms. So.
Okay. Well, Michael, I'll hand it back to your question if you can remember what that question was now.
Yeah, I was kind of curious about the programming model. So it's not really image based, but you do runtime compilation.
Well, it's image based in the sense that you need a snapshot to run Slate. The parser and the compiler and all those things, you know, are in an image snapshot, and the VM really only contains some bytecodes, some primitive methods, and so forth. The source, however, is all maintained outside of the image. The image will keep track of the location of source in files. And so as we bootstrap into an IDE, and we already have some facility for this, you can go from a debugger stack, and it'll have a link to source code, or it'll show you source code in the frame, and you can open it up in an editor and take a look at it and recompile stuff using a workspace-style editor, that type of thing. Generally speaking, of course, the feel of it is that you're running a traditional, well, I wouldn't say traditional, but a typical scripting language that just happens to have a snapshot feature. And, of course, it needs to bootstrap itself sometimes.
Does that mean if you're debugging in GDB, you have the GDB compiled symbols in there so that it links back to the source code as well?
Oh, well, yeah, that's true, but the GDB stuff isn't aware of anything in Slate. I'm usually referring to the debugger that's inside the Slate image itself.
Okay.
Yeah, which is it's a read eval print loop, which happens to have navigation features. You almost like, I like to think of it as a dungeon crawl. And in fact, the Slate evaluation model has been used for a MUD, which was kind of fun, actually.
How do you build the snapshot that you're using then? Does it require an existing runtime to make?
It requires an existing runtime. So you grab an image, and we've got a makefile rule. We got a makefile rules for most of the typical things you need to set up, including like how to build your external plugins and so forth.
So how do you big bang this thing? What if you need to start from scratch and all you have is your source code?
Well, you go back to the original Lisp interpreter.
You start from there.
And honestly, we maintain so many generations of the image and keep track of when and where it was compatible so that we don't have to do that.
So there's the similarity to Smalltalk right there.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if maybe that's a sort of a conceptual flaw in many respects. But then again, I guess in the C world, the bootstrap is just so not an issue because there's so much C everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, libc is, for all intents and purposes, the C bootstrap library. You know, without libc, you kind of can't run anything that will run libc unless you write your own compiler that runs on Metal. You know, that.
So along that line, then, why not change that snapshot into more of a modular library model that you can, you know, the VM will run that whenever you start up, but it's not really a snapshot of the runtime. It's just a snapshot of the required tools to compile code.
Exactly. Wow, that's an amazing suggestion. In fact, I've thought about it before, and it's pretty much like I actually have an idea that I have kind of bounced around sometimes and not really gotten not really pulled through, but basically I would like, and maybe someone out there who's like a really clever hacker, it doesn't even need really that much cleverness, could write a linking protocol in the same way that we write linking for C libraries or other dynamic language libraries. The idea of taking, you know, compiled code and maybe some suite of objects that are all kind of gathered together and describing their interfaces, you know, like how, what symbols they actually need to bind to in order to be looked up correctly. And, you know, and then there, of course, there's the parameter of like, how would you join this with another object tree? You know, is it going to be, have a root that then gets plugged into something like that? I definitely, and this stems from another aspect, I think, of First Slate, which is I think of Slate as a, as an operating system with a shell. And it just so happens that you're hosting it within another operating system. But, you know, the idea of having standard libraries and relinkable directories and stuff like that plays pretty hard into the reason why I chose prototypes instead of going for like maybe a specialized class system like Newspeak did, or you know, some more namespacey oriented like Smalltalk that you know, use packages and some other nested object system.
Well, what one thing, yeah, that I made a programming language, or I guess my friend David did most of the work, which we called it Self. There was an experiment in trying to push Self along. And I just bring it up because what we had were our libraries or our modules were actually object databases. So it was, we had a standard object format, and standard object format worked in memory and on disk. And that meant when you compile stuff, you basically just made the objects and dropped those objects into a file that you could load up into another system. And because they were objects that were named, you could then basically import them into your runtime.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, and it also meant that external tools could look at this stuff. So anytime you wanted, you could just point to a library and say, okay, what's in here? And it would show you all, you know, be able to interpret that stuff without having to run it. And that meant debugging was really useful. But that kind of goes against what you were talking about with the introspection, where essentially the programmer should be able to invent any kind of random concept they want, so long as they provide the standard introspection APIs. So in that respect, you could have an object binary sitting on disk, and you would load it up and then expect three entry points of introspection that would allow you to get at everything. But you would have to, at least you would have to run it to be able to access its data, because that would allow it to be encapsulated within itself.
Yeah, there's, well, you can maybe define interfaces for that sort of thing, and, you know, I don't even know what I would advocate. I'm okay with actually quite a lot of these approaches. And in fact, right now, there's a little library we're messing around with that's basically inspired by Rubinius's RBC format, and it's super simple. It's a little text file that recurses. And so, like, we wrote up a little way to serialize and deserialize typical objects, typical data structures, and also source trees. So it's a quick way for us to say, like, parse a bunch of files, compile them to disk. Now we have a quick way to load them or reload them. We don't have to, you know, rely on the speed of a particular parser.
Yeah, except that still requires you to interpret them when really...
Oh, yeah.
You need it to interpret itself, essentially.
Yeah, I understand. I don't have a good answer for that. A lot of these things are like, you know, I agree in principle, and it is a question of like, when is it going to become enough of a pain that we need to, you know, put attention on this limited attention that we have, you know, and just do it. So, and then on sometimes the practical, like, dynamic situation that we have as a project might influence, you know, as much what we wind up doing as what we wanted to do originally, you know, as the aesthetics maybe.
Let me jump this one level back out for a second. I wanted to ask, you know, in addition to asking earlier where people could get a hold of the code, let's say you got a hold of the code and you wanted to write something. From what everything you guys have been talking about, you've been primarily talking about the implementation and what the goals are of that. But let's say you wanted to write something more practical from a developer standpoint, not the language developer standpoint, but what I like to call the dumb application developer. You know, maybe you wanted to write something that dealt with RSS feeds so that you could put something on a website. You wanted to build a little website application of some kind. How close are you, or are you far enough along now that you could actually write something real in this?
We're getting pretty close lately. I've got our third developer right now has been writing kind of web sniffing or parsing and generating DSLs for us. And he's been exercising the direction there quite well, to the point that I actually feel pretty confident we could do something with RSS pretty easily. We don't have any, you know, we have a Unicode library, but it's not built in by default. You have to kind of run something to get it integrated. And I'm trying to think, what are the other like hardcore requirements? Most everything, as far as like getting stuff out of a socket or serving stuff on a socket, that's kind of done. You know, it may not have like the most robust implementation, but there's something you can go with. You can certainly go with the fast CGI interface. We've got a library for that, you know. And I don't know. I don't really have a lot of drive to use Slate in anger, so to speak. I sort of leave that up to others, but unfortunately, you know, that's another bootstrap problem for a community.
Right, but what it sounds like is, if somebody did have that desire, they could grab the stuff you've got on your website and in the Google code repository, and they could at least make a start at trying to build something they were interested in using Slate. And if they ran into roadblocks, obviously they could call you, but you know, send an email.
I don't think Slate's ready to do bottom feeder yet, James.
No, I'm not talking. No, nothing was ready for bottom feeder. Not even Smalltalk.
Not even the people who used it.
Yep. Not even people were ready for bottom feeder. No. So, no, but I was just thinking though, somebody could attempt to write something real in this, and then if they ran into roadblocks, obviously they could communicate with you.
Yeah, and we don't have the kind of documentation you need to be able to sort of self bootstrap. If you're going to write some serious applications and so forth, sure the libraries are there, but you know, getting around them and knowing like, you know, those important clues of like, you know, what this is meant to do, it helps to ask or to be really savvy about digging around in code and figuring out you know, what the call graph is and stuff like that. So.
Okay. Well, that's pretty much the last bit of things I wanted to ask. Michael, do you have anything more you wanted to cover?
There's heaps we could talk about, but we're probably pushing it for time, unless we want to try and beat Joystick's two-hour-long podcasts.
No, I'm not mentally prepared for beating Joystick's two-hour podcast, unless you hand me a stick and maybe I could beat them.
Yeah.
But no, I wanted to thank you, Brian, for coming on and giving us the time. It's been a great conversation.
Yeah, it's always great to talk to new people about this.
All right. Well, thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this week's podcast, please tell other people about it. We'd love to have more Smalltalkers and more developers learning about Smalltalk through the industry misinterpretation of the podcast. If you have feedback, send it to smalltalkpodcasts@syncom.com. Head on over to Facebook, join the industry misinterpretations group. Head on over to Ning and join the Smalltalkers group. Or head on over to Podcast Alley and cast a vote for the podcast. In the meantime, have fun with Smalltalk.